Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 22nd, 2015. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Matt Miller, a.k.a. Dr. Lambic, will join us to talk about brewing Creek Lambics and employing a three-step fermentation to accommodate lactobacillus, saccharomyces, and britannomyces at different times in the process. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus as well. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly, greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We are everywhere. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. And thanks to everybody who's done so already. And if you do so, I will send you a link to the special bonus video that Steve and I did earlier this year. Matt and I talked for a long time, but I want to take a quick look into the mailbag. Before we go further, Kevin from Rural Hall, North Carolina writes, "Just finished listening to this week's podcast. I heard some recommendations for nitrogen dispensing. The information was very timely. I was going to be heading out to the local welding supply to get my nitro tank filled. I haven't brewed a nitro stout in years. Chris Colby's tips were very helpful. One tip that I have tried is to carbonate the beer at a low level using 100% CO2. Then disconnect the CO2 tank and hook the nitrogen tank to the beer and dispense at 25 to 30 PSI. This is a quicker way to get the beer from keg to glass. It takes much longer to use the beer blended gas alone." Well, very nice. I appreciate that tip, Kevin. I haven't played with nitrogen myself. I've received a handful of similar requests in the past couple of weeks. So whenever that happens, I think it's maybe time to do a show on that topic. Listeners want to know when we're going to do a follow-up show on brewing software. It's been several years since we've talked about software on the show, and a lot has happened, including new hardware platforms like Android. I don't think Android existed the last time we did a show. I could be wrong. The trick is that I am not an expert on the topic. I don't use a lot of software. So I'd be depending on you for feedback and information. So do you want to help in putting together a show on brewing software? If so, send me a note at james@basicbrewing.com or use the contact form on the site. And let me know what software you use, how you use it, and what you like and what you don't like. And if I get enough feedback, we'll put together a show. And maybe we'll do a drawing from those who have participated and send out a logbook as a thanks for your help. So if you like brewing software, if there's something that you use, let us know how you do it. I mean, do you go from your phone to the cloud to your desktop machine to the whatever you do? Help us put together a brewing software show and get us up to date, because it's been a while since we talked about it. We have a sponsor this week. Founded in 1978, the American Homebrewers Association is a thriving community of people who are passionate about beer and brewing, from expert homebrewers to folks who are just getting started with their first extract brew. More than 44,000 members rely on the AHA for money-saving member deals, event discounts, brewing resources, and general camaraderie. As a not-for-profit organization, the AHA relies on members to support their work to promote, protect, and grow the homebrewing craft. Support your passion and join your tribe. Visit homebrewersassociation.org and become a member today. I've been a member for many, many years, and I enjoy it. I enjoy the benefits, especially, I mean, if you've heard the many times that you've heard Gary Glass on this show talking about the lobbying efforts that they've done to make homebrewing legal across the United States, just that alone is worth supporting. One note before we headed to the interview, Matt and I talked about what the wort would taste like after pitching lacto and before pitching yeast, before pitching Saccharomyces. And Matt has this word of caution. Matt says, I was thinking over what we covered for the show, and I wanted to mention a caveat about the portion we covered on tasting the wort for acidity. I've done this a number of times without ill effect, but I don't typically recommend it for brewers who are unsure of their processes, because before the Saccharomyces fermentation, there is no guarantee that the wort wouldn't cause food poisoning. The point I consider wort to be completely safe for consumption is when it has a definite pH below 4.5 and an ABV of 2% or greater. So there you go. Some sound advice from Dr. Lambic. Better safe than sorry. Now let's talk to Matt. Matt Miller, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Lambic, as you go by, and your website is sourbeerblog.com, and you were kind enough to send me a sample. I guess we should we're going to talk about creeks, and you were kind enough to send me a sample, and something happened that has not happened to either one of us, I gather. The beer actually froze in transit. We were having single digit lows here in Northwest Arkansas, and I don't know if it froze here or froze up where you are or what happened, but I opened the box, and there was a wet spot on the box, and that's not a good sign. So I thought that the glass had broken from being mishandled, but I opened it up further, and the beer had frozen in the bottle and had popped both a cork and a cap.
Yeah, winter shipping problems. It's the first for me, too, but I'm glad you at least got to taste a small portion of the beer.
Yeah, I posted on Twitter and our Facebook page that when UPS gives you frozen beer, make an ice beer, which is what I did. It was I set it on the counter for a little bit, and some of the tasty bits thawed out, and I was able to pour that away from the water ice that was left in the bottle. And what I had was good. I'm sure it's not anywhere near the fully balanced product, but it was nice and tart. What I tasted was a fairly clean, not too funky bit. I'm hoping that you'll give me another chance when the weather warms up and send me another bottle.
I'm happy to.
So we're talking creek. What is a creek?
A creek traditionally produced in Belgium would be created by spontaneous fermentation of a pretty simple recipe that produces a wort made by about 60% malted barley and about 40% unmalted wheat. They use a fairly high percentage of aged hops to give the beer a certain character and also restrain some early microbial growth so that it follows a fermentation that yields good results using the spontaneous wild bugs that they have in the air and in their barrels. And after a base lambic is produced, and the closest thing that most people would drink and be familiar with before a beer becomes a creek would be a goose. Gooses are a blend of various ages and flavor qualities of base lambic. But a creek is produced by taking that lambic beer and soaking it in fresh sour cherries for generally a couple of months until the beer takes on that cherry character, and then it's bottle conditioned until it's ready to be served.
In some commercial cases, they, I take it, add sugar to sweeten it up a little bit?
Yes, they do. And there are a number of examples that are typically just called kriek in Belgium that have been back sweetened or added. They may add even artificial sweetener so that they don't become dry again in the bottles. But then the style that I am a bigger fan of and target my brewing towards is typically called oat kriek, which for them just means, you know, done in the traditional methods. And those styles are very dry. They're not sweet, very, you know, a sour, dry, wine-like beer.
I would assume that the sweetened ones are meant to maybe make the beer more palatable toward a younger audience, maybe.
I think that's the theory, yeah.
But we like the sour stuff.
Oh, yeah.
If you're like me. Now, as you said, traditionally, you know, these are brewed in Belgium with what they call spontaneous fermentation, just using bugs from the air and in the barrels to ferment the beer. But in reading your article on in your sour beer blog, I take it you don't go that route.
I don't. One of the reasons I don't go, I don't try to recreate the traditional Belgian process is because without the exact microorganisms that they're using and the cultures that they've sort of generationally developed, I find that, and I've read a lot of experiences that sort of deterred me away from that early on, is that the lab cultures and a lot of the Brettanomyces and Lactobacillus cultures that we have access to don't do a real good job with that type of wort, with the high age hopping levels. And the experiences that I've seen when using the trying to use a traditional method without the real traditional bugs that are being used there in Belgium, is you get a beer that just never achieves the right level of acidity, doesn't get to the proper level of attenuation in the time period that it should. And what tends to happen then is you wait way longer than needed, you know, up into the like 3-year, 4-year range to try to get an acidity to form. And by that time, any acidity that is forming tends to be a vinegar. It's acetic acid from the slow uptake of oxygen over all that time. So that early on, I tried to come up with methods that would work with the bugs that we have easier access to.
It seems you'd get more predictable results. I have had really tasty homebrew spontaneous fermented beers. And I always put, you know, invisible quotation marks around spontaneous because, you know, it's not really spontaneous fermentation. It's, you know, the beer doesn't ferment itself. There are bugs in the air that fall into it. Just like, you know, they used to say, you know, the theory of spontaneous generation in the old days that if you leave meat out, it will generate flies, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why I put the quotation marks around it. But that's just me being a stickler for the thing. But anyway, so you can do it, but as you know, Mike Tonsmeyer said in the past, when we had tasted some of his spontaneously fermented beers, you know, depending on what place you put it around the house, the unfermented wort to gather the bugs, you know, at what time of year, there's so many variables that you may get good beer, you may get not so good beer.
Yeah.
So this is it's a way to, you know, get more predictable results. And I would think that, I mean, there's so much time invested in this whole process that, you know, that seems to be, you know, kind of a prudent thing to do on the whole.
Yeah, the methods that I have found to be my favorite for producing sour-based beers that will eventually become blended into either creeks or other fruit lambics or other sour beer projects altogether, typically use like a three-step fermentation process. And that process that I like to use is a pitching of just a lactobacillus culture up front. I have the most experience with White Labs Lactobacillus delbrueckii, but I have had good results with with other lacto cultures as well. They're Brevis and also cultures from Giga yeast. There's a fast souring lacto that I've found tends to work nicely, and I usually pitch those into the wort for 2 to 3 days at anywhere from 80 to 115 degrees. Although the higher you can keep that temperature, the less chance you have of some competing off flavor producing bacteria taking hold. And after that initial pitch with lactobacillus for a few days, then the wort gets cooled down to a regular ale temperature, mid-60s to low 70s. And at that point, I oxygenate the wort and pitch in any of a wide variety of ale strains. I like WLP-007. That's like a dry English ale yeast. For probably the most kind of balanced later Brett production, but I've also used like California ale yeast or Belgian strains like an Abbey ale in these beers as well. And they all the choice of your brewer's yeast can vary pretty widely and gives you some options to play with for complexity later on. And after the beer ferments and attenuates as you would expect it to normally with the ale yeast, then I pitch a fairly low pitch of Brettanomyces. I don't do a starter on those. I like to pitch usually just one vial or smack pack per 5 gallons and let that age for 3 to 6 months to see a nice development of Brett character and Brett esters. And I've found that by pitching the Brett in sort of a low cell quantity into a beer that's already has a good base of lactobacillus and is fairly attenuated by Saccharomyces, that the Brett stresses out, it has to work a little harder to get going, and it usually produces a nice balanced level of farmyard to fruit characters based on that fermentation schedule.
Yeah, so this was something new to me. Maybe I'm behind the times, but this idea of doing a step fermentation, creating kind of conditions, you know, that each of these bugs likes, you know, the traditional way, I guess, is to throw all the bugs in there, the lactobacillus, the saccharomyces, and the brettanomyces into the wort at the same time, you know, after chilling.
Right.
And then let the bugs do what they want. But
which can work very well. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that method. The only the reason I had started experimenting with the like a three-step fermentation early on was just reading various results that people were having with pitching the bugs all at once. And it seemed that if something is going to go wrong with that fermentation, it tended to be the level of acidity that was achieved. that people would get a nice beer. It was clean. It was balanced. It would develop a nice Brettanomyces character, but not always developing the acidity that they were looking for.
Hmm.
So that initially had me thinking to experiment with the lactobacillus up front. And at least the theory that I go with on that is that the lactobacillus is the least competitive of those organisms as far as access to sugars. The brewer's yeast and the Brettanomyces are more aggressive fermenters than lactobacillus. So by giving it sort of a couple of days up front to do its own thing, it can multiply, really establish a nice colony inside the beer, and start to produce some acidity before these more aggressive organisms get a chance to get in there and compete with it.
It's sort of similar to the way that I've been playing with sour mashing and sour worting, in that I collect a wort, cool it down to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which is around 50°C, something like that. Then inoculate with lactobacillus, and I use unmilled two-row, basically, to get my lactobacillus. And then let that sour for 3 days in my electric smoker, because I use small batches, to get the sourness. And then, I boil that wort for a short period of time, chill it, and then add the Saccharomyces. So this is something similar, although it all happens post boil, right?
Right. Right. The beer that I produce is boiled using normal boiling practices. I don't do short boils. I like to do a full 60 to 90 minute boil, and then chill it down into that 110 to 120 degree Fahrenheit range, and pitch the lactobacillus, and hold it in those temperatures for however long the lacto is going to be in the beer by itself. And and then the other side of the three step fermentation is trying to get the most out of the Brettanomyces as well. And in the production of the creeks and things that I'm looking for, I am looking for a fairly aggressive level of Brettanomyces funk, some barnyard, some leather, hay-like qualities, things like that from the Brettanomyces. And when using Brettanomyces up front in a primary fermentation, you tend not to get a lot of those characters. The Brett isn't as stressed, and it usually produces more esters, more fruity characteristics, and less phenolics. Whereas by pitching Brett into a beer that's essentially done fermenting with Saccharomyces, it's pretty highly attenuated already. The only thing the Brett can go after is the more complex carbohydrates, the sugars that the ale yeast could not ferment. And in those situations, it has to work harder, it's more stressed, and it tends to produce more funky phenolic character.
And I would assume when you are, after you boil, you're going to be boiling most of the free oxygen out of the wort.
Right.
And you want that, right? When you pitch the lactobacillus in that first stage, you want to keep the wort away from oxygen, right?
That's right. Yes, that is right. Lactobacillus can ferment in an oxygenated wort. The oxygen won't kill it, but it prefers to be deoxygenated.
And you're also, by keeping the oxygen out, you're discouraging the invasion from other microbes that will spoil the beer in another way.
Yeah. there's a number of different types of microbes that can spoil a lactobacillus-only fermentation, and that is a point to be careful with. If there's a point in this whole fermentation process where something can go wrong, it'll be during that lactobacillus-only portion. Other bacteria can get in there and wreak some havoc and create a lot of weird, fecal or vomit-like stinky feet, all types of nasty aromas and flavors that you don't want in there.
As well as a vinegary or just vinegar flavor.
Yes, exactly. There's a couple things you can do to discourage that. One of those, like we said, is keeping the oxygen out. Another is the temperature range. Generally, if you're above 112 degrees Fahrenheit, there's a family of bacteria called Clostridium that cannot ferment or survive in wort above that temperature. So keeping the wort hot will favor the lactobacillus and discourage Clostridium, which eliminates a lot of the chance for the vomit, bile type flavors that could develop. And the other thing that can be a benefit is to pre-acidify the wort before you pump out of the kettle. If you have a way to check the pH, you can actually reduce the pH of the wort with something like food-grade phosphoric acid or food-grade lactic acid down to 4.5. And by reducing the pH of the wort down to 4.5, you restrain the ability for Enterobacter. There's a number of other bacteria that do not like pHs below that 4.5 level. So taking it down to that to start really helps to keep those things from competing or creating problems. And then the last thing that you should do and always practice is if you're doing single pitches of something like a vial of lactobacillus, is just good clean sanitary practices. I mean, if you run your wort into the thing hot, into your fermenter hot, and you'll want to use something like a metal keg or a plastic, what do they call them, jerry cans, like the Australians are using to cool their wort overnight.
Yeah, for the no-chill.
The no-chill methods. Containers like that, if you run the wort in hot, seal them up, you can let the wort cool to that 120 degrees. That essentially gives you a sterile or sanitized environment as possible. And then if you use good sanitary practices to put in your lactobacillus culture, you're eliminating the chances for other bacteria to get in there just based on your techniques.
And we should probably say that there's a safety factor that you shouldn't pour hot wort into a glass container.
Yes, I don't. The method I've been using lately to do this that I find works really well is actually just to run the wort off at near boiling into either the plastic containers or a metal keg, and seal it up, let it cool, and you've essentially got wort that's as close to being canned inside that container as you can get.
Now, you were talking about lowering the pH to make the lactobacillus happy or to keep the other bad bugs out.
Right.
You don't want to have the pH so low that it creates an inhospitable environment for the Saccharomyces and the Brettanomyces, right?
That's right. Saccharomyces, too low of a pH can affect both families of yeast. Brettanomyces is more tolerant of a lower pH. A lot of stuff I've seen suggests that it can ferment pretty healthily, even down at a pH of about 3.3 or slightly below that. But for Saccharomyces, you typically want to pitch that into your wort before the lactobacillus has a chance to drop it much below 3.6 or 3.5 pH is the lower limit of where you want to go there.
So if you don't have a pH meter, is there a sort of guide to, you know, tasting?
Well, yeah, there would be. You have to remember that the lactobacillus, when it's lowering the pH and producing acid, tends not to attenuate the beer very much, so it's still going to be very sweet. You won't expect it to be an intensely sour beer, regardless of what it tastes like, because of the amount of sugar still left in solution. But the at pHs above 4.2 or so, you won't perceive any acidity in the beer. Or most people, I can't perceive much acidity in the beer at a pH of about 4.2. As you drop down towards 3.9, 3.7, you'll start to notice that there is a little bit of acidity starting to balance that sugar that's still left in the wort. And down in the 3.5 to 3.6 range, you'll definitely be able to perceive that, yes, it's sour, and it's also still sweet.
So you've, at this point, you know, you've had the lactobacillus in the wort for, what, a couple, 3 days?
Usually 2 to 4 days is the average for what I've done. And the other thing that you can keep in mind is that the lactobacillus, I think during this primary fermentation, you're not necessarily trying to do what you're trying to do with a Berliner Weiss, where you create all of your acidity up front and whatever you've produced is all you're ever going to get. There's a number of these fermentations I've run where I haven't reduced the pH down to 4.5. So you're starting in a range of about 5.2 to 5.4 with your wort. And the lactobacillus, by pitching about 1 vial per 5 gallons, usually in 2 to 3 days will drop that pH down to anywhere between 4.2 to about 4.7. And even though that's not very acidic at that point, I think it has given the lactobacillus a real nice starter type of environment. It's really built up its numbers within the beer. And then if you go ahead and pitch your ale yeast and then later your Brett at those, even at that level, I've seen all of those beers then within 3 to 6 months drop down to about 3.3 in pH, which is quite acidic.
Yeah, and that's the big difference between the method that I've been using to do the Berliner Weiss type beers with the wort souring pre-boil is that, you know, you sour the wort, then boil it to kill off the lactobacillus, the souring organism, and then you have a fermentation with clean yeast afterwards. So, you know, the sourness that you achieve before the boil is the sourness that you're going to get. It's not going to get any more sour.
Right.
Which I guess is a benefit in that you don't have to worry about, you know, getting sour bugs on your fermentation vessels or your post-fermentation gear.
Yeah. Exactly.
But on the other hand, it's not going to get more sour the longer it sits in the fermenter.
Right.
So you say that after you achieve the initial boost of sourness from the lacto pitching, then you introduce oxygen into the wort before you pitch your Saccharomyces?
Right, I do. I oxygenate typically using pure O2 for about a minute in a 5 gallon batch, and then pitch the Saccharomyces after doing that.
So you want the Saccharomyces to be happy.
Yeah. Yeah, the goal of the three-step fermentation is for each organism to sort of get to either maximize what you want out of it or to give it the best environment for what it wants. And for the lactobacillus, you're trying to give it the most sugar possible. For the Saccharomyces, you want it to be happy and you want it to produce a clean beer for you that's reduced any, you know, metabolites like diacetyl or acetaldehyde. You want your Saccharomyces to be real happy so that you have a nice clean beer free of all flavors before you introduce your Brettanomyces and let it create a funk and character for you.
And I assume that this the Saccharomyces is gonna do the standard amount of time for a proper fermentation.
Yeah. Anywhere, depending on strain and you know, gravity, you're looking at anywhere from 3 to 7 days probably for primary fermentation. I like to just a general brewing practice that I'm a big fan of is doing sort of a diacetyl rest on all beer, you know, regardless of it's really popular for lagers because it's generally absolutely necessary, but even just all my ale fermentations, I like to turn the temperature up a few degrees during the last 10-15% of attenuation. Once you see that the yeast is starting to slow down, turn that temperature up a couple of degrees to really drive the fermentation home towards the end. You get the attenuation that you're looking for, and also helps to clean up any of the off flavors that are left over from the primary fermentation.
And then the Brettanomyces goes in. And do you rack to a secondary at any point?
Yes. You don't necessarily have to, but I tend to rack off of the primary yeast cake before I add the Brettanomyces, because the Brettanomyces will be in there for anywhere, depending on how the beer develops for you, from a couple of months to a couple of years. So the it's good to transfer the beer off of that primary yeast cake of Saccharomyces so that you don't get a large breakdown over a long period of time.
It seems like to me that this is certainly a more sort of controlled way of pitching these critters, these microorganisms. What advantages does it give you besides that? Is it a quicker process?
It can be accelerated. I've used this process to produce things like Flanders Red style beers that develop a real nice level of acidity and character in anywhere from 3 to 6 months, which is somewhat accelerated compared to using, you know, a mixed culture right from the beginning. Sometimes those take a bit longer. But the other benefit that I've seen is just consistency and repeatability. I have yet to have a beer that hasn't soured or achieved the acidity that I was looking for. And also, they've all developed various levels of funk and nice phenolic character as well over time. You know, each batch is still slightly different. You're not going to produce an identical beer every time. There's still some variables here, length of time that each bug has with the beer, and also what strains you choose. But it seems like a good method to walk your sour beers into sort of a general range of end characters that you're looking for.
And I take it in reading your article that variability between batches is a positive because you're blending these.
It is. I sat down with a friend of mine that brews with me just the other day, and we blended together a number of samples just to test the some of our most recent batches. And it's surprising how beers that seem very similar some of the beers in the series, if you drank them 10 minutes apart, would seem almost identical. But when you sit down and blend a couple together, there are little nuances that come together and sort of fill in and round out character in a way that is almost difficult to plan for. You have to kind of taste what is what's happening before you can be sure what to do with that. But yeah, variability is a key to producing, especially beers like lambic style creeks, lambic style goozes. You want variability in your program. You want a wide variety of flavors to pick from so that you can ultimately blend together what you're looking for.
And what are you looking for?
That's hard to define. It's something that's easier to know when you taste it, as far as, you know, once you're happy with it, you'll know. But you're looking for, in a creek, for example, in the base beers that you're putting in there, you're going to want a moderate level of acidity. You don't want it to be an enamel scraping, you know, intensely puckering sour beer, but you also don't want it to be lackluster in acidity. It should be about the same acidity as a ripe sour cherry. If you eat a tart cherry and you get that like sourness from the fruit, that's sort of the level you're looking for in your blend before you put the fruit in as well. And you're looking for a beer that has a wide and complex range of Brettanomyces flavors. You can really go a number of places across the board. And if you drink the traditional examples from Belgium, it really is the Brettanomyces character and kind of the differences and which characters they choose to include in their blends that differentiates the different producers and, you know, gives them that house flavor that distinguishes like a Cantillon from a Dreyfontaine from a Hansen's. Those type of flavors largely come from the different wide variety of characters you'll get out of Brettanomyces.
Now, and you spend a lot of time in the article talking about how to calibrate your taste buds, you know, by drinking lots of examples of good creeks and good lambics commercially available.
I do think that's very important. I think that, you know, for any blended product, anything that you're going to really key in and dial in the flavors for, you need to develop a good palate memory of just knowing what it is to expect. If you're trying to recreate the style, you want to drink good examples of the style and become familiar with them, because they are variable. There's a wide range of different possible flavors that are all good. And there's also examples that didn't turn out good. I mean, I've had bottles of world-class lambic, you know, or I've had bottles from world-class lambic producers like Cantillon or Dreyfontaine that just did not develop properly. There's something wrong with them. They went to vinegary or other issues in transportation, storage. You know, the beer isn't always perfect. So you want to drink enough examples to know, you know, that the few you had were good ones.
Now, we've talked a lot about fermentation, which is good, which is the, I mean, I wanted to spend a lot of time on that since this is sort of a new concept to me, at least. But now that we produced our base beers, and we've blended together a nice blended beer, now we've got to talk about fruit and putting it on fruit. Talk a bit about that. What kind of cherries are we using, and how do you add them? And give us the details.
For traditional creek styles, this is the one difference where American versions are going to taste a little different, but still be, you know, you can produce excellent examples with their own American flair, because the varieties of sour cherries that we get, while are very good, they're not going to taste identical to the varieties that are available in Europe. In general, you want to use a tart cherry, the type of cherry that would be used for like a cherry pie. You don't want to use the supermarket type sweet cherries that you can get, you know, pounds of in the summer in the supermarket. They taste great to eat raw, but there's a lot of a lot more water in them per volume, and they just don't produce the same. They'll produce a lackluster cherry flavor if you try to use them in the same quantities that you would use like a nice tart cherry. I've had real good luck with Montmorency cherries, but really any variety of American tart cherry that tastes good and has a nice acidity can be used. And to sort of finish up and blend your final creek blend, what you want to do is have your base beer ready, have produced something that you know are happy with and really could be drank on its own. You want the beer to taste good before the cherries go in it. And then you'll add cherries at a starting rate. A good starting rate is about 2 pounds per gallon. You want about 2 pounds per gallon, and you can go up or down depending on, you know, what you have access to. But crush them up. You don't need to blend them or purify or, you know, liquefy them, but at least smash up the fruit so that the insides are exposed, and add that into your beer at about 2 pounds per gallon. At that point, you want to see the Brettanomyces will wake back up. It'll start to re-ferment the sugars that were in those cherries over a period of usually a couple weeks till you see that activity end. And then generally you let that fruit rest on the beer until it tastes right, usually 1 to 3 months or so to get a good extraction of flavor and to get the beer to re-ferment out and dry out nicely. The other thing I should mention is that traditional creeks derive some of their flavor from the cherry pits as well. There's an almondy, there's a tannic almond character that comes from cherry pits, and it's a nice flavor. It's definitely one of the components that I try to recreate in my creeks. Unfortunately, a lot of sour cherry sources in the U.S. are going to be pitted. They won't have the pits in them. So for that, I actually do buy market cherries and take the pits out. Just eat the cherries, and then I take the pits and put them directly into the beer along with the frozen sour cherries to try to let the pits give their character to the beer as well.
Huh. Now, you said frozen. Is this do you hold with the old adage that you freeze fruit before you put it in the beer to break the cell walls?
I don't think you have to do that. If you can use fresh fruit, that would be fine as well. The Brettanomyces is fairly, should be fairly aggressive as long as the fruit is crushed up a bit. And it has access to the inside pulpy parts, it will get in there and start to break down those walls and extract things on its own. But frozen is a great option as well, and you do, frozen cherries give very good results.
So a couple of weeks on the cherries, and then is the beer ready to package, or do you need to age it some more?
The beer is ready to package when you think it tastes right. It ultimately comes down to flavor and when you're happy with it, it can be ready to package. Now there is the issue of attenuation and dryness. The beer should be stable for a while if you're going to bottle condition it. You have to be careful with that. I'd recommend anyone that's interested in doing their own bottle conditioned sours pick up a copy of Mike Tonsmeyer's American Sour Beers, because he has an excellent section in there that gives information on that. But I am a fan of counter pressure filling and kegging for homebrew in general. So that's what I typically do with my beers is I let them achieve the attenuation and the dryness that I would like the final product to have, and then, you know, carbonate in a keg and fill bottles from there. Of course, doing that with sour beers, you will have to have some duplicate pieces of equipment, because I wouldn't want to run clean beer through a bottle filler that had ever had Britannomyces and lactobacillus and those type of bugs in there. It could be done, but you'd want to, I think, boil the whole thing for quite a while to ensure that it's been sanitized.
Invest in an autoclave. Befriend your dentist buddies and people that have autoclaves at work. So I'm taking it. I can picture your aging cellar. In fact, I think there is a picture of your cellar, and you've got a lot of carboys that are occupied.
Yeah.
It seems like brewing sour blended beers would lend itself to that. You know, in that you will have sort of an archive of different beers of different ages to call upon.
Yeah, and there's definitely a benefit to that. If you can, the more variety and the more options you give yourself, the more dialed in and the wider, you know, range of flavors you'll be able to incorporate into your final product.
I will post a link to your article, which is very extensive and well written and a nice read. I'll post that in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. And I look forward to another attempt in warmer weather of getting an opened bottle of your beer.
I'll definitely send one. I look forward to getting your feedback.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, James.
Well, thanks again to Matt, Dr. Lambic. Now, there's another technique to put on my list to try, and it makes perfect sense to pitch the different organisms at different times and different conditions that support them, make them happy. And once again, I'm going to put a link to Matt's extensive blog post in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. Remember to send me your feedback and experience in using brewing software. It's been a while since we addressed brewing software in the show, and if I get enough input from you guys, we'll talk about it again. I think it's time. It's been a long, long time since we talked about it on the show. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, recommendations on brewing software, just want to say howdy right to James at basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can see listening to the fine folks across the country sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. If there is a vendor in your area, you can order them online at our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Making Sauerkraut and Pickled Vegetables at Home, Creative Recipes for Lactic Fermented Food to Improve Your Health. That title sounds familiar. I might have read that before, but I thought it was appropriate for the topic. And Beyond Brisket Basics, a how-to guide on smoking Texas-style competition brisket. You can tell it's lunchtime. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodds. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.